The Oblong Box. Some years ago, I booked passage on a ship from Charleston, South Carolina, to New York. The ship was called the Independence, and its captain was Captain Hardy. We were to sail on June 15th, weather permitting. The day before, I went aboard to arrange some matters in my stateroom. I learned that we were going to have a great many passengers. On the list were several people I knew. Among these, I was pleased to see the name of Mr. Cornelius Wyatt. He was a young artist who had been my friend at the university. Wyatt was practically a genius, although he could be moody. He also had the warmest and truest heart a human being ever had. I noticed that Wyatt's name was listed on 3 staterooms. I saw that he had booked passage for himself, his wife, and his 2 sisters. The staterooms were quite roomy, and each had 2 beds, one above the other. I could not understand why there were 3 staterooms for these 4 persons. It was no business of mine, to be sure. Still, I set about trying to solve the puzzle. Finally, I thought I had the answer. "It is a servant, of course," I said. "What a fool I am not to have seen it sooner." Once again I looked at the list. But here I saw clearly that no servant was to come with the party. Yet the original plan had been to bring one. The word servant had at first been written and then crossed out. "Oh, it must be extra baggage," I now said to myself. "It is something he doesn't wish to put in the hold. It's something he wants to keep under his own eye. Ah, I have it. A painting. Perhaps even the copy of the Last Supper he has been trying to get." This idea satisfied me, and I thought no more about it. I knew Wyatt's 2 sisters very well. They were friendly and clever young women. Wyatt had recently married, and I had not yet met his wife. He had often talked about her to me, however. He described her as a woman of great beauty and wit, so I was quite anxious to meet her. On the day I visited the ship, June 14th, Wyatt and his party were also to visit it. I waited around for an extra hour in the hope of meeting his wife, but then an apology came. Mrs. Wyatt was a little ill. She would not come aboard until tomorrow at the hour of sailing. The next day arrived. I was going from my hotel to the wharf when I met Captain Hardy. He said that, owing to circumstances, a stupid but necessary phrase, the Independence would not sail for a day or two. He said that when all was ready, he would send a message to let me know. I did not receive the captain's message for nearly a week. It came finally, and I immediately went on board. Wyatt's party arrived about 10 minutes after I did. There were the 2 sisters, the bride, and the artist, who was in one of his bad moods. I was somewhat used to these, so I didn't pay much attention to it. He did not even introduce me to his wife. This job fell to his sister, Marion. In a few hurried words, she made us acquainted. Mrs. Wyatt's face had been covered by a veil. She raised it to respond to my bow. When she did, I must confess, I was very surprised. The truth is, she was a very plain-looking woman. If she wasn't positively ugly, she was not very far from it. She was dressed, however, beautifully. I had no doubt that she'd captured my friend's heart because of her intelligence and her good soul. She said very few words and went at once to her stateroom with Wyatt. My old curiosity returned. There was no servant, that was settled. So I looked for the extra baggage. After some delay, a cart arrived at the wharf with an oblong pine box. As soon as it arrived, we set sail. As I said, the box was oblong. It was about 6 feet in length and about 2.5 in width. Now, this shape was odd. As soon as I saw it, I knew my earlier guess had been right. The box had to contain a painting. I thought the matter was finally settled. One thing bothered me, though. The box did not go into the extra stateroom. It was put into Wyatt's own room. It remained there and took up almost the whole floor. On the box's lid were painted the following words: "Mrs. Adelaide Curtis, Albany, New York. Charge of Cornelius Wyatt, this side up. Handle with care." Now I knew that Mrs. Adelaide Curtis was the artist's mother-in-law. Why would the painting be sent to her? I looked upon the entire address as a mystery intended just for me. I made up my mind, of course, that the box would never get farther north than my friend's studio on Chambers Street, New York. For the first 3 days, we had fine weather, so the passengers were in a good mood and were quite friendly. I must say that included everyone but Wyatt and his sisters. They behaved stiffly and were mostly unfriendly to the rest of the party. Wyatt was gloomy, even beyond his usual ways. Still, I was prepared for his moods. His sisters were another matter. They kept to their stateroom during most of the voyage, and they refused to talk with anyone on board, even though I urged them to do so. Mrs. Wyatt was far more friendly. She became friendly with most of the ladies and even some of the men. She amused us all very much. The truth is, I soon learned that Mrs. Wyatt was more often laughed at than with. She was said to be a good-hearted thing, plain-looking, uneducated, and somewhat vulgar. The great wonder was how Wyatt had been trapped into such a match. Wealth was everyone's general answer, but I knew that was no answer at all. Wyatt had told me his wife had not brought him a dollar. He had married, he said, for love and for love only, and his bride was more than worthy of his love. When I thought of my friend's words, I was very puzzled. Was it possible that he was losing his mind? What else could I think? One day he came up on deck. I took his arm and we walked together back and forth. He was still quite gloomy. He said very little, and that was with great effort. I tried a joke or two, and he made an attempt to smile. Poor fellow. I thought of his wife and wondered that he could smile at all. Finally, I brought up the oblong box. I began a series of comments about it. My aim was to let him know, bit by bit, that I was not to be fooled about its contents. I said something about the odd shape of that box. As I spoke these words, I smiled, winked, and poked him gently in the ribs. The way Wyatt took my comments convinced me he was mad. At first, he stared at me as if he didn't get the meaning of my words. Then, a moment later, as he understood them, his eyes seemed to bulge from their sockets. He grew very red, then quite pale. He began to laugh loudly. He continued this way for about 10 minutes. Finally, he fell face down on the deck. When I ran up to him, he seemed dead. I called for help. After a while, he came to. But for a time, he didn't make much sense when he spoke. Then we put him to bed. The next morning, he had recovered. At least, his body had. Of course, I can say nothing of his mind. I avoided him for the rest of the trip on the advice of the captain. He seemed to agree with my opinion of Wyatt's mind, but he asked me to say nothing about it to anyone else on board. Several other things happened after this to add to my curiosity. For 2 nights, I could not sleep very well. My stateroom opened into the main cabin, as did those of all the other single men on board. Wyatt's 3 rooms connected to the after cabin. It was separated from the main one by a sliding door. This door was never locked, even at night. The tossing of the ship often caused the sliding door between the cabins to slide open. It stayed that way because no one got up to shut it. When my stateroom door was open, as well as the sliding door, I could see quite clearly into the after cabin. In fact, I could see exactly where Wyatt's staterooms were. Those 2 nights while I lay awake, I clearly saw Mrs. Wyatt leave her husband's stateroom at about 11 o'clock. She entered the extra room where she stayed until daybreak. Then she was called by her husband and went back. That they were separated was clear. They had separate rooms and were probably heading for divorce. Here, finally, was the mystery of the extra stateroom. One other thing that happened during those nights interested me. After Mrs. Wyatt had gone into the extra stateroom, I could hear noises coming from Wyatt's room. After listening for a while, I determined what they were. The artist was prying open the oblong box and removing the lid. He used a chisel and a mallet. He had obviously tried to muffle the noise by covering the mallet's head with some cotton or wool. After this, there was a dead silence. I heard nothing more until daybreak, unless I mention what sounded like a low sobbing or sighing sound. I say it sounded like sobbing or sighing, but of course it couldn't have been either. I think it was just a ringing in my ears. Wyatt had simply opened the box to gaze at his art treasure inside. There was nothing in this, however, to make him sob. That's why I say it must have been my imagination. In the morning, I heard him put the lid back on the box. Then he came out of his stateroom, fully dressed, and called Mrs. Wyatt from hers. We had been at sea for 7 days and were now off Cape Hatteras. At that point, we caught a heavy wind from the southwest. We were prepared for it, though. The weather had been threatening for some time. Everything was tightened and secured as the wind steadily increased. We rowed safely enough for 48 hours. At the end of this time, however, the storm had become a hurricane. One sail split into ribbons, and we took on a lot of water. We lost 3 men overboard and part of the ship above the upper deck. We hardly had recovered from this when we lost another sail. The ship continued to take on water. To make matters worse, the pumps became clogged and were nearly useless. It was decided finally to abandon the ship. After much hard work, we were able to get the longboat over the side without an accident. The entire crew and most of the passengers crowded into the boat. This party took off right away. They arrived at Ocracoke Inlet in 3 days. The captain and 14 passengers remained on board. This group decided to try their luck with a smaller boat at the ship's stern. The boat was lowered without much difficulty, though it nearly turned over when it hit the water. I was among the group in this boat. In addition to the captain and his wife, the group included Wyatt and his entire party. We took a few necessary tools, some food, and the clothes upon our backs. No one had even thought of trying to save anything more. We were shocked then when Wyatt stood up in the boat just as we pulled away from the ship. He demanded that Captain Hardy move the boat back so he could take along the oblong box. "Sit down, Mr. Wyatt," the captain said sternly. "You will capsize us if you do not sit still." "The box," Wyatt yelled. "The box, I say. Captain Hardy, you cannot. You will not refuse me." For a moment, the captain seemed touched by Wyatt's pleading. Then he recovered and spoke calmly. "Mr. Wyatt, you are mad. I cannot listen to you. Sit down, I say, or you will swamp the boat. Stay, hold him, seize him. He is about to spring overboard. There, I knew it, he is over." As the captain said this, Wyatt in fact jumped from the boat. He managed by almost superhuman strength to get hold of a rope hanging from the ship. A moment later, he was on board, rushing down into the cabin. We tried to get back close to the ship, but our little boat was pushed farther and farther away by the rough seas. Our distance from the wreck increased quickly. Wyatt came back on deck, dragging the oblong box with him. We watched, amazed, as he tied a 3-inch rope first around the box and then around his body. In another moment, both the body and box were in the sea. They disappeared suddenly, once and forever. We remained a while, our eyes sadly fixed on the spot. Finally, we pulled away. No one spoke for an hour. Then I said, "Did you notice, Captain, how suddenly they sank? Wasn't that an unusual thing?" "They sank as a matter of course," the captain said. "They will soon rise again, however, but not till the salt melts." "The salt?" I shouted. "Hush," he said, pointing to Wyatt's wife and sisters. "We must talk of these things at a better time." We suffered much and made a narrow escape. After 4 days, we landed on the beach opposite Roanoke Island. We stayed here a week and then booked passage to New York. About a month later, I happened to meet Captain Hardy on Broadway. He then explained the entire matter of Wyatt and the oblong box. The artist had booked passage for himself, wife, two sisters, and servant. His wife was, as she had been described, a most lovely woman. On the morning of June 14th, the lady suddenly became ill and died. The young husband was filled with grief. He could not, however, delay his trip to New York. Now he also had to take the corpse of his beloved wife to her mother, but to do so openly was out of the question. Most of the passengers would have abandoned the ship rather than sail with a dead body. Captain Hardy came up with a solution. The corpse was first partially embalmed, then packed with a large amount of salt. It was placed in the oblong box and marked as cargo. It was known that Wyatt had booked passage for his wife, so it was necessary for someone to play her role. The dead woman's maid was easily called upon to do so. During the day, she performed, as best she could, the part of her dead mistress. At night, she slept in the extra stateroom. My own mistake came from too careless and curious a nature. But lately, I rarely sleep soundly at night. There is the red face of Wyatt that haunts me, and there is his crazed laugh that will ring in my ears forever. The Cask of Amontillado. The man Fortunato had done me 1,000 wrongs, and I had put up with them as best I could. But when he started to insult me, I vowed revenge. I did not utter a threat, though. You who know the nature of my soul so well must know that. In time, I would set things right. And I would do it and not suffer any punishment for it. I did not give Fortunato any reason to suspect me. I continued to smile in his face. He could not know that my smile was now at the thought of his death. In many ways, Fortunato was a man to be respected and feared. But he had a weak point. He took pride in his expert knowledge of wine. In this matter, he and I had something in common. I was an expert in the Italian wines myself. I bought them in casks or barrels whenever I could. Early one evening, during the mad carnival season, I met my friend. He greeted me very warmly, for he had been drinking heavily. He had on a jester's costume. On his head was a cone-shaped cap with bells on it. "My dear Fortunato," I said, shaking his hand, "how very well you are looking today. I have received a cask of what passes for Amontillado, but I have my doubts." "How?" he said. "Amontillado? A cask? Impossible, and in the middle of the carnival." "I have my doubts," I said. "And I was silly enough to pay the full Amontillado price without talking to you first. You were not to be found, and I was afraid of losing a bargain." "Amontillado?" "I have my doubts," I said. "I must satisfy them. You are busy. I am on my way to see Lucrezi. If anyone can tell, it is he. He will..."
"Lucrezi cannot tell Amontillado from sherry."
"And yet some fools will say that his taste is a match for your own."
"Come, let's go," he said.
"Where?"
"To your vaults," he answered.
"My friend, no," I said. "I will not take advantage of your good nature. I think you have some place to go. Lucrezi..."
"I have no place to go. Come," he said.
"No, my friend, I see you have a bad cold. The vaults are very damp."
"Let us go anyway. The cold is nothing."
"Amontillado?"
"You have been taken advantage of. And as for Lucrezi, he cannot tell sherry from Amontillado."
With that, he took my arm and led me toward my home. My servants were not at home. They had left to attend the carnival. I'd told them I would not return until morning. I had given them orders not to leave the house. I knew these orders were good enough to make sure they would leave as soon as my back was turned. I took two torches and gave one to Fortunato. Then we walked through several rooms to the archway that led into the vaults. We went down a winding staircase and stood upon the damp ground of the catacombs. My friend's walk was unsteady. The bells upon his cap jingled as he walked. "The cask," he said. "It is further on," I said. "By the way, how long have you had that cough?" He turned toward me. His eyes had the look of someone who was drunk. My poor friend could not answer for many minutes because of his cough. "It is nothing," he said at last. "Come, we will go back," I said. "Your health is important. You are rich, admired, and loved. You are happy as I once was. You are a man to be missed. We will go back. You will be ill. Besides, there is Lucrezia."
"Enough," he said. "The cough is nothing. It will not kill me."
"True," I replied. "But you should be careful. A drink of this Medoc will protect us from the dampness." I took a bottle of wine from a long row. "Drink," I said, handing him the wine. He raised it to his lips.
"I drink to the buried that lie around us," he said.
"And I to your long life," I answered. He took my arm again, and we walked on.
"These vaults are quite large," he said.
"The Montresors were a large and important family," I said. The wine sparkled in his eyes. My own body grew warm from the Medoc. We had passed through long walls of piled skeletons mixed in with large casks. I stopped again and grabbed Fortunato by his arm. "Moisture drips among the bones," I said. "It is very damp. Come, we will go back before it is too late. Your cough..."
"It is nothing," he said. "Let us go on. But first, another drink of the Medoc."
I gave him another bottle. He emptied it at once. His eyes flashed with a fierce light. He laughed and threw the bottle upward with a gesture I did not understand. I looked at him in surprise.
"You do not understand," he said.
"No," I replied.
"Then you are not of the Brotherhood."
"Who?"
"You are not of the Masons."
"Oh, yes, yes," I said.
"You? A Mason? Impossible."
"A Mason," I replied.
"Show me a sign," he said.
"It is this," I said. And I produced a trowel from under my cloak.
"You joke," he cried. "But let us proceed to the Amontillado."
"So we shall," I said. I put the tool beneath the cloak again. I offered him my arm, and he leaned on it heavily. We walked down, down until we arrived at a deep crypt. The air was foul. At the far end of the crypt was another smaller one. Its walls had been lined with human remains. On three sides of the crypt, bodies were piled all the way up to the vault above. The bones from the fourth side had been removed, leaving an open space. In this wall, cleared of bones, was an alcove about 4 feet deep, 3 feet wide, and 6 or 7 feet high. Behind it was a wall of solid stone. "Ah, here we are," I said, "at last." Fortunato tried hard to see inside the alcove, but the torch's flame had dulled, and there was not enough light. "Go on," I said. "Inside is the Amontillado. As for Lucrezia..."
"He is a fool," my friend said.
He moved forward with an unsteady step. I followed right at his heels. When he hit the stone wall, he stood still, puzzled. On the wall surface were two iron rings. From one ring hung a short chain. From the other hung a padlock. I threw the chain around his waist and secured it. Within seconds, I had him chained to the wall. He was too shocked to fight me. I withdrew the key and stepped back. "Pass your hand over the wall," I said. "You cannot help feeling the mold. It is very damp. Once more, let me beg you to go back." "No." "Then I must leave you. But first, I will do what little I can for you." "The Amontillado," my friend cried. He had not yet recovered from his shock. "Yes, the Amontillado," I replied. I walked over to the pile of bones on the ground. I threw them aside and uncovered some building stone and mortar. With these materials and my trowel, I began to wall up the entrance to the alcove. I had hardly laid the first row of stones when I discovered that Fortunato's drunkenness had worn off. I could hear a low, moaning cry from deep inside. It was not the cry of a drunken man. There was a long silence. I laid several more rows of stone. Then I heard the furious shaking of the chains. I stopped working and sat upon the bones. When the clanging stopped, I resumed my work. When I had laid several more rows, I threw a weak light upon the figure inside. There was a series of loud, harsh screams from the throat of the chained man. This went on for some time. By midnight, my work was almost finished. When I had nearly put the last stone in place, I heard a low laugh from inside. It was followed by a sad voice. I had trouble recognizing it as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said, "Ha, ha, a very good joke indeed. We will have many a rich laugh about it over our wine." "The Amontillado," I said. "He, he, yes, the Amontillado. But isn't it getting late? They will be waiting for us, the Lady Fortunato and the rest. Let us be gone." "Yes," I said, "let us be gone."
"For the love of God, Montresor," he pleaded.
"Yes, for the love of God," I said. I listened for a reply. It did not come. I called aloud, "Fortunato!" No answer. I called again, "Fortunato!" Still no answer. I thrust a torch through the remaining opening and let it fall in. In return, there came only a jingling of bells. My heart grew sick. It was the dampness of the place that made it so. I hurried to finish my work. I forced the last stone into place and plastered it up. I moved the old stack of bones against the wall. For 50 years, no man has disturbed them. May he rest in peace.